How do we go about feeding a planet that's hotter and more crowded than ever? Climate One Conversations feature oil companies and environmentalists, Republicans and Democrats, the exciting and the scary aspects of the climate challenge. I'm Greg Dalton. The connection between global warming and the dinner table isn't always obvious when we go to the grocery store, but our choices about how we put food on our plates and what we do with the waste contribute as much as one-third of total greenhouse gas emissions. How can we continue to feed a growing population without destroying the planet in the process?
The food sector is a place where we're seeing real climate solutions, and a lot of environmentalists are starting to realize that farmers, who really are both on the front lines of the climate impacts, but also they're on the front lines of the climate solutions.
Anna LaPay is author of Diet for a Hot Planet, The Climate Crisis at the End of Your Fork and What You Can Do About It. A generation ago, her mother, Frances Moore LaPay, published the revolutionary Diet for a Small Planet. Anna will join us later to examine the climate crisis and solutions within our food system, along with author Mark Kurlansky, who's explored global food history in best-selling books about salt, fish, and milk. First, how is technology changing the food system?
A lot of the people working in the ag space are not hands-in-the-dirt people. You know, they're IT folks, they're mechanical engineers, electrical engineers. There's a much broader definition, and that's both exciting and concerning.
Amanda Little is a journalism professor at Vanderbilt University who also writes for The New Yorker and Bloomberg about energy, food, and climate. Her most recent book is The Fate of Food, What We'll Eat in a Bigger, Hotter, Smarter World. She's joined by Twilight Greenaway, a contributing editor with Civil Eats, an online source of news about food, health, and environment. They will talk about reinventing the global food system to be more productive and nutritious. I began our conversation, recorded in June of 2019, by asking Amanda about Memphis Meats, a company in Berkeley, California, that she writes about in her book.
Memphis Meats is producing what are called cell-based meats, which are meats that are grown from cells taken from animals, but grown outside the animal. And the cells are given sort of a very comfortable environment in which to grow in a bioreactor, which in lay terms is a very sophisticated crock pot, essentially, and grow until they form muscle mass and are blended with connective tissues and fats and essentially a meat product that is meat, just grown separate from the animal. And I tested a cell-based duck breast about 9 months ago or so in the Memphis Meat Laboratory. But that interested me as part of this growing industry in alternative meats.
Because much of the climate conversation really gets down to meat and protein. A lot of it's animal protein. And this lab meat, you know, is one way to kind of, in theory, reduce the environmental and greenhouse gas impacts of factory farms, the intensive impacts of industrial production of animal protein, right? So there's a lot of big companies. Tyson invested it in Memphis, Cargill, even Hormel, maker of Spam, is looking at this kind of thing. Is this where meat is going, away from the pasture to the lab?
Yeah, actually, I got interested in the story in part because I was writing about Tyson for Bloomberg, and I found that they were investing in Memphis Meats. Cargill Meats had come in, I think, first, and then Tyson came in thereafter. A number of, you know, sort of more predictable investors had also come in, Bill Gates and Richard Branson and so on. But I thought this was fascinating that the conventional meat industry was investing in sort of disruptive technologies, and asked Tom Hayes, who was then the CEO of Tyson, why are you going into cultured meats, or, you know, aka cell-based meats or lab meats? And they said, he said, if you can grow the meat without the animal, why wouldn't we do that? There's a huge, you know, resource advantage for us, and obviously ethical advantages to growing the meat without the animal. And he said, we see disruption in the auto industry, we see disruption in tobacco, you know, disruption is coming in the meats industry. That fascinated me, that this was, you know, something that conventional meats were investing in. Now, granted, it's a small, you know, fraction of what they're investing in conventional production methods, but the conversation is starting.
A lot of that is driven by the ability to lock up intellectual property, which businesses like, investors like, to kind of put a moat around their investment so new competitors can't come in. Twilight Greenaway, does this idea of lab meat or industrial, does that fascinate or horrify you?
A little bit of both, I think, like a lot of Americans. I recently was thinking about this issue, actually, when the announcement was made. Tyson decided to do an end run. It looked like they were going to be, really, for the most part, putting their money into existing companies, and then they kind of decided to put their own products out. At the time, I was thinking about a conversation that had happened years ago about this idea of an organic Twinkie, and I don't know if any of you remember that.
Organic Twinkie.
Yeah, so okay. There was a discussion of, now that organic is having this groundswell, what will it mean when there is organic junk food, basically? There will be the benefit on the one end. There will be the, there's a lot to say about changing practices on the land and what organic means in terms of pesticides and other environmental benefits. But on the other hand, you'll still end up with a Twinkie. And I think that that discussion felt very apt when I started to think about cell-based meat plant-based meat, and the investment and the huge kind of groundswell around seeing it as the solution. And I think there are obvious benefits. There are also some downsides. And so for me, it feels very similar. One of the main questions I have is about the ingredients that go into that, particularly the plant-based meat. How will it be raised? Will it be regenerative on a large scale? I think it was it Impossible that just came out declaring their pride at using American genetically modified soy? So I do think that it's very complicated, and I'm curious to see how it plays out.
So Amanda, yeah, your response. I mean, GMOs, there are a lot of people on the left are rabidly against them. Other people say, well, is there cell editing? There's all sorts of techniques here. But really what we're talking about is kind of the role of innovation and technology and food, whether food ought to kind of be like our grandparents or a product that's engineered and designed to address the hunger and climate challenges we're facing.
Yeah, and I'm interested to get to the GMO topic. With the lab-based or the cell-based meats, it's interesting because some of the claims, I mean, the potential is so exciting that there actually could be health benefits. Memphis is, there are many of these cell-based companies that are emerging, and so Memphis is only one of them. But the Uma Valetti, the founder, who is a cardiologist by training, was interested in potentially, the human health benefits of bringing in healthy fats, also addressing some of the contamination problems in meats, that this would actually do more than sort of what an organic Twinkie would do. It could create a lot more safety for the eaters of the meats and certainly offset, of course, the impacts on the animals themselves. So in theory, it's really exciting. Certainly, what is the medium in which the cells are grown? What is the cost of this from an energy standpoint? How great are the potential climate benefits? A lot of that we don't yet know, but in concept, it's exciting. And this is what's so interesting about a lot of these areas of food tech or what they call climate smart agriculture that are emerging. The benefits seem to outweigh the risks by a long shot, but we're so early in the phases of a lot of these technologies that it's really hard to say for sure, this is a slam dunk.
And I think it depends a lot on who we're talking about is benefiting, right? I mean, I think there are very clear benefits. I'm really interested in who's producing the food and how. And I think a lot about rural communities. I think a lot about small and medium scale producers. And I feel like that I would like to see that piece of the conversation integrated into the discussion around cellular meat more than it has been.
One of the people that got me interested in this was not just Tom Hayes, the Tyson CEO, but a farmer who produces meats and on a small farm. He uses managed grazing, rotational grazing, and he basically said the challenge is that what I produce on a small scale is not affordable for my neighbors. So who am I to begrudge some of these sustainable approaches that can produce cheap meat sustainably, with better human health and environmental impacts? If we can't all necessarily go to Kraft meats, what is the solution for a middle and low income meat eater? And so was his interest in this as a potential solution for sort of the mass produced meats, not necessarily as an alternative to craft meats, but
that's my prediction, is that ultimately this is going to be what's in our fast food. I think there will always be a grass-fed steak available to the elites.
And that's what I think the folks who are in this area are saying, too. I mean, they don't see this, completely offsetting. I think, actually, Pat Brown of Impossible Foods has said there will be no animal-derived meats by 2035 or something. He's made some pretty dramatic claims that
That's his wish.
That's right. I don't know that that is shared by everyone in the alternative meats industry, but it is pretty extraordinary how far things have come. I mean, to see the Impossible Food product now adopted in Burger Kings and White Castles and Shake Shacks and so on, when 3-4 years ago people were saying, will mainstream consumers go for the veggie burger that bleeds with synthetic animal blood? This seems so far-fetched. The fact that we're seeing these ideas that had seemed far-fetched get embraced and adopted pretty rapidly is surprising to me. Again, exactly what the benefits are and how these industries are managed is another question.
But Amanda Little, you mentioned kind of the small, iconic American rancher. If meat is produced in a laboratory owned by a large corporation that is serving institutional shareholders, doesn't that just wipe out the small scale cattle rancher,
consolidate
power and economic power in the industry?
I don't think so. I think, as Twilight was saying, they're different products, and so what?
But if this is aimed toward the mass market fast food, and yes, the people on the coast can have their grass fed beef if they continue to eat meat, which is questionable in a hot world. But isn't that just going to consolidate power when Cargill can have its own factories? They don't need ranchers when they own the factories producing this meat.
Yeah, and I think it's creating a lot of concern for stakeholders in those conventional meat industries. I will say that a month after I reported in Bloomberg on Tyson's decision to get into alternative meats, Tom Hayes, the CEO, resigned. And I'm not saying that it was because of the piece, but it's a tough time. The meat industry has been going through all kinds of price instability related to tariffs and other things. But it's a tough time to be talking about self-disruption in an industry that's been sort of a bit volatile. And I think that there's a lot of concern about how it's managed and what it means to control have ownership over cells that are grown and all this stuff. I mean, there are many, many unanswered questions and risks, and the way that the oversight and the way in which environmental activists and policymakers shepherd the growth of these industries and make sure that we do this in the right way is essential. It's they're big questions.
And Twilight Greenaway, do we even know the life cycle analysis of lab meat? Is it really less greenhouse gases to produce fake meat than real meat?
Great question. I haven't seen that yet, and I don't think it's out. I mean, we do have some life cycle analysis for plant-based meat. There's been a lot of discussion around that lately. There's also been some new life cycle analysis around pasture that's come out in the last few weeks. They're both from the same third-party organization, Qantas, I think it's called. Neither are peer-reviewed. So there's a lot of fast talk at this moment, but I'm glad you brought up ownership, because there were a lot of great things about your book, and one of the questions that kept coming up for me was about the role of technology and what that technology ultimately does. Is it going to feed the system that we have, which is very top-down? Few companies own the bulk of it, whether we're talking seeds, whether we're talking pesticides, whether we're talking meat. Mm. And so many of these startups, their goal is to sell to these big companies, as you mentioned, with Blue River, for instance. But I think it's fairly common that that's the business model. So are they feeding into this system that is extremely top-down, or will there be technology that comes along? And I do think there probably is some now, but will there be some that really can feed into a more democratic food system that allows for different types of ownership, less concentrated ownership? And that's my big question.
You're listening to a Climate One conversation about our diets. Coming up, can cutting-edge technologies in traditional agriculture create a climate-smart food system?
We need the scale. We need the sort of good guys and bad guys to collaborate, right? Maybe this is a way of bringing more intelligent practices to industrial ag.
That's up next when Climate One continues.